From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Today, we'll learn about efforts to better educate people about Sikhism as we approach the 10-year anniversary of the Sikh temple shooting in Oak Creek. Then, we'll learn about a local effort to improve the quality of lunches at Milwaukee Public Schools.
Half the time, the meals are always frozen, and there's not that much flavor into it, and it's really stale, and it still leaves us, like, really hungry.
We examine some of the pitfalls of automated hiring systems.
Just as bias is introduced into hiring humans, the use of human beings, and human decision makers, we also know we can build bias into automated systems.
All that's coming up on Lake Effect, but first, here's today's headlines. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Thanks for joining us. Mass shootings targeting marginalized groups continue to happen in this country. From an elementary school in Uvalde, Texas, a predominantly black neighborhood in Buffalo, New York, and a Taiwanese church in California. There's been more than 200 mass shooting incidents in the U.S. so far just this year, and the number keeps on climbing. Nearly 10 years ago, a hate crime like these took place right here, at the Sikh Temple of Wisconsin in Oak Creek. Six people were killed when a white supremacist stormed the temple. The crime horrified the community, including Shauna Singh Baldwin, an award-winning author and educator. She spent more than a decade educating the public about Sikhism and joins WUWM's Eddie Morales to talk about her work.
In 2012, a white supremacist opened fire at the Sikh Temple in Oak Creek. Were you living in Wisconsin at the time?
Yes, I was on my way there, in fact, another half hour probably, and I would have been part of that. And then my husband and I rushed over there. As soon as we heard about it, a friend of ours called us from Oak Creek and said, turn on the TV. And the next minute we were in the car and racing over there because I also felt that, you know, they might need interpreters. And so my husband and I were outside the temple for about 5 hours waiting for news of our friends inside. It was the most terrifying time because six people died that day and the seventh passed away in 2020 after spending so many years in hospital. It was a terrifying time because we thought that believing in the Constitution of America was all that was required to be American. And we hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal. But there are people who think they're patriots but do not believe that.
So how has the shooting affected you?
It's affected me terribly, I think. One gets a little bit wary of one's neighbors, and it's not a good premise to be wary of your neighbors. One must be open-hearted, and that is one of the precepts of our religion, of our faith, to be giving, to be generous, to do seva, to wish everybody well. Sarbat da bhala is what it's called. So for us, our teachings are very much in conflict with the natural reaction to close the doors and to go inside and to just put up the walls, but you must tear down the walls, and that's what our religion teaches us. So it really was a good guide in those days.
To try and tear down walls, you've been giving presentations to non-Sikhs about the culture and religion. Tell me about your activism and outreach since the 2012 shooting.
Yes, one of the things that I felt in the days following the shooting was that we felt that we needed to do more outreach, but we're not an evangelical religion. We're not proselytizers. In fact, it's a very personal thing, your relationship between you and the Creator. So from that standpoint, it was very unusual for us to decide to be more outgoing. And I actually have prepared a presentation, which I've given to numerous organizations now, just describing our faith and describing what we believe in, and you know, that we're not Hindus and we're not Muslims, but we don't mean to say we're not Hindus and not Muslims, so go after them. That's not the idea either. So it was very difficult to come up with a message that didn't say, oh, well, we're not Muslims, go find the Muslims and kill them instead. You know, that wasn't the idea. And that was a time in which, you know, there was a lot of anti-Muslim feeling, and we caught the brunt of it in many respects. But that isn't healthy. You know, we have to be more outgoing and share our stories so that, you know, people see that we're just human, just like them. At the same time, I also realized from having married into an Irish Catholic family that there's no need for the majority community to actually have anything to do with us or have any curiosity whatsoever. In 36 years that I've been part of the family, nobody has ever asked me what I believe in or wanted to go to the temple or anything, because they have no need to. So I also realized that we're asking for a lot where it comes to the majority community. At the same time, we must insist upon inclusion because we are Americans. We have been here for 100 years or more, actually 120 years since the first Sikh arrived in North America. Our history is to insist upon inclusion no matter what.
What are the biggest misconceptions that you're seeing from people as you work to educate them?
They just plain don't know anything about us. So there's that. There's also a misconception, you know, that all of us wear turbans. Well, more orthodox Sikhs do. Some do, some do not, you know. They also seem to think that anybody who wears a turban is a Muslim. But 99.9% of the people who wear turbans in this country are Sikhs. So there's things like that the misconceptions are just plain religious illiteracy in this country. That's the saddest part. Not to say it doesn't exist elsewhere too. You know, I've been a minority now in 3 countries, and it's not pretty being a minority anywhere. But that doesn't mean that we don't keep trying and we don't keep interacting with people. Going internal is not the solution either. And what's been very nice, actually, is that after the shooting, we've actually managed to bridge some of these divides and talk to people as human beings and say, you know, to understand each other a little better.
You mentioned people don't know anything about Sikhism, and a 2014 National Sikh Campaign survey backed that up. 60% of Americans said they know nothing at all about Sikhs. What do you find non-Sikhs are most eager to learn?
Well, they like our food. We offer free food at the Gurdwara every Sunday, and I haven't met anyone who doesn't like Indian food after all. But food is a wonderful segue into discussion about what do you believe in, what do you think about things, how do you, what is your occupation, why do you do certain things and you don't do other things. I mean, we have the same ignorance, by the way, about our fellow Americans sometimes, you know. And we learned about that too when we were in these help groups afterwards, in the mourning groups and the grieving groups that we brought together with other people. People didn't know, for instance, that we don't bury our dead. We cremate. That we don't believe in karma the way Hindus do. We believe everything happens, your karma happens to you in the same lifetime. There are things like that that, you know, people are confused.
So do you feel that more people know about Sikhs now than in the past, or does that 2014 statistic still seem accurate?
It's still accurate, unfortunately, and we're working on it. We're working it as hard as we can, but we do it one person at a time. We do it by reaching out one person at a time, one heart at a time.
It's been 10 years since the shooting. What gains have we made as a society, locally and nationally? What's still left to do?
We have to reach out to each other. We have to break bread together. We have to come together. There's no hope for it. If we don't, then we condemn ourselves to more of these mass shootings. We can't live in this kind of state of eternal suspicion of our neighbors. This is ridiculous. I think we're going to go downhill if we don't start doing the Sisyphean task of moving that boulder uphill and reaching out and saying, you know, come together. This is one country, and it's hard sometimes when I hear people say things in my presence that they really think are meant only for one color of person. That's not good. So we must call it out when it happens in front of us. We must share our stories. We must do as much as we can, but each person has to work on this. We can't just leave it up to our leaders, because obviously this is not working right now. It has to be up to each one of us.
Well, Shauna Singh Baldwin, thanks for speaking with me, and good luck with your continued outreach efforts.
Thank you for having me.
Shauna Singh Baldwin is an award-winning author and educator. She spoke with WUWM's Eddie Morales. As we reflect on the 10-year anniversary of the ambush of the Sikh Temple of Wisconsin in Oak Creek, we want to also remember the temple's leader who was killed that day, Satwant Singh Kalika. Satwant's son, Pardeep Singh Kalika, has tried to live up to his father's philosophy. He's worked with Serve to Unite, co-authored The Gift of Our Wounds, and currently is the executive director of the Interfaith Conference of Greater Milwaukee. Pardeep joined me back in August of 2018 on the 6-year anniversary of the Sikh temple shooting to reflect on the many facets and memories of his father's life. Here's just a bit of that conversation.
Your father had a favorite saying, work is worship, and you mentioned that farming was sacred work for him as well. And throughout his life, after he established himself here in Milwaukee, was building businesses, building the temple, and you mentioned he had this truck forever. Like, no matter how well he did or anything, like, he constantly rode that truck or was doing repairs himself, things like that. You know, do you think that was kind of a good example of who he was like kind of the character that he kept this truck around and just did everything by himself no matter how good things were going?
No, it definitely was. He never bought a new car. And at some point he had gotten to the point where he was financially capable to buy a new car or a house or, you know, what you name it, but he was financially capable of doing that. But he had so much of that humility from when we didn't have money that he would definitely do everything on his own. Whatever he could do, he would do on his own. That truck was actually a gift that I gave to him. It was beautiful. It had an 8-foot bed, which is perfect for like drywall, flooring, and all kinds of things, right? And so that truck is still, I mean, it's still in our family now. And it keeps running and keeps running and keeps running. But he was the type that he would work himself to sleep. There was times when he would be jackhammering. And now this man is 170 pounds. He's really wiry and super strong for, like, the size that he was. And he would never give up. He was like that, just that wiry fence that, like, you just can't cut. It's like you just have. It's like almost a pain in the ass, and so he would outwork you. He would outwork you. And there was days when he would work himself so hard that he fell asleep for 3 miles, and you get home and he's collapsed out again, taking ibuprofen. But he wanted to push you.
With the anniversary coming up, I imagine, of course, it's a somber time. But as the years pass on, you know, does your reflection of your father change with every anniversary?
Yeah, it does. Early on, I think as much as we were trying to put a brave face on for the world because we felt the responsibility to do so, it was very emotional. I mean, emotional to the point that it was hard to reflect on some of these good and bad memories. And, you know, when somebody loses somebody in that capacity, there's this sense of processing that needs to authentically happen. And for us, yes, we put, you know, but we were gritting our teeth through a lot of that. We were still mourning. We were still thinking that the world is unfair. Everybody is out to get us, against us. So there's this anxiety with it and all types of feelings that you have wrapped up in, you know, your emotional skin that you're processing through. So over time, it has very much become a journey of authentic healing. And I can, I, it changes now because now, since his death, my wife at that time was 7 months pregnant. And my youngest two boys had never seen their grandfather. But they speak as if they know him. And they speak as if he's a friend. And I think there's something spiritual within us and within our DNA that lets them know and feel that he's still there. And there's mannerisms that they have that I know that they haven't picked up by seeing him move around, but they just have to be genetically encoded. And there's things that they say that he would have said. And there's this sense of, I guess, in myself, the sense of contentment and gratitude towards life being that way, that we can get to a point where we can really spiritually heal because we know that the person is not dead, but has transitioned.
Pardeep Singh Kalika is the executive director of the Interfaith Conference of Greater Milwaukee and the son of Satwant Singh Kalika, the leader of the Sikh Temple of Wisconsin in Oak Creek, who was killed 10 years ago tomorrow. Our conversation first aired in 2018, and there's a lot more to it, and you can listen back at WUWM.com. Coming up later in the show, we'll examine some of the pitfalls of automated hiring systems and how they may be attributing to the current worker shortage. But first, we'll speak with a local high school student who's helping to organize the effort to improve school lunches for Milwaukee Public Schools. Keep listening to Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. You're listening to Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. A fresh school year is right around the corner, but not all students took the summer off. Milwaukee Public School student Eliza Palacios has been organizing other students around the quality of school lunches and much more. Palacios is an organizer for Youth Empowered in the Struggle, also known as YES, the youth arm of Voces de la Frontera. YES launched its School Lunch Justice campaign earlier this year. In March, YES released a list of demands for Milwaukee Public Schools based on survey responses from students throughout MPS. WUWM Community Engagement Coordinator Rafa Munoz sat down with Palacios earlier this week on Instagram Live, and here's a part of their conversation.
Can you tell us a little bit about YES's School Lunch Justice campaign?
The YES School Lunch Justice campaign, we're trying to make school lunches what MPS students deserve. And at the beginning, we did a survey, and the main thing in the survey was the school lunches. So then we surveyed again, asking, what does a good school lunch look like to you? What are your favorite and least favorite lunches? And then us YES leaders had a meeting and created the 6 demands that we have now from what all the students said.
So you surveyed MPS students, it sounds yes. Like more than once, and collectively you kind of decided to, there's 6 demands now. Could you tell us yes. A couple, just a couple of the demands?
I can tell you the demands. The number one is provide fresh school lunch that is cooked at the school by food service staff with locally sourced ingredients. Number 2, provide more lunch options at the same time. 3, put a system in place that identifies and accommodates students' personal, religious, and medical dietary needs. 4, provide larger, more filling meals that leave students feeling ready to learn instead of hungry. 5, hire more lunch staff to cook meals and increase their wages. And 6, MPS Board of Directors establish regular meetings with YES members to ensure these demands are met and implemented with student voices at the table.
Could you tell us a little bit about the structure? Because from what it sounds like, it's different students that are a part of YES working at their individual high schools. Is that right? Could you tell us yes. A little bit about that?
There is Reagan, Riverside, and MSL. we all went to our regular Thursday meetings and we decided on the demands. Well, we talked about it first. We looked at what everybody liked and what the students wanted. So we kind of just went off from each other one by one, what we think we should put as a demand and what we think we should hold on for a different, like for later on in our fight for these better school lunches. And we just moved on from there, basically.
So what it sounds like is your meeting is all of YES members, but there's also individual meetings at
their school.
So the school lunch campaign was announced earlier in this year. How did you become involved with YES? And I guess just tell us why you decided to get involved with YES too.
I got involved with YES because two of my best friends were in YES, and they're like, you should come to an in-school meeting with us. And I was like, sure, I don't see why not. So I went in there, I met Mr. Fleissner, which is, it's a teacher at Hamilton, and I met him through it. And they started the meeting, and I realized what they were fighting for. And I thought, this is a really great thing to do. I really want to be in it. And so that same day, I went to the Thursday meetings with all the other schools. And that's when I put in my membership for YES. Ever since then, I've created such really good bonds with Mr. Fleissner, another organizer, and Ari, our organizer, and a lot more other people at different schools. And it makes me feel really happy to be in something that's really important.
I think I'd really love to hear why this specifically, like the school lunch campaign, is important for MPS students like you, because it seems like there's some really tangible demands that y'all have made. But like, why is it important to accommodate dietary restrictions? Like, why is it important for you as students to get a fresh meal?
For us as students, why it's important to get a fresh meal is because half the time the meals are always frozen and there's not that much flavor into it, and it's really stale, and it still leaves us like really hungry. And I know at Hamilton there's people that sell snacks because kids are still hungry and they won't even touch the lunch sometimes. I have friends that won't even get a lunch, and I thought to myself, this is ridiculous. We need really good lunches.
I think with the start of the school year just right around the corner, what are some next steps for YES and for the school lunch justice campaign?
So right now, we are going to be meeting with food service workers through the MTEA to understand what they care about. And then we plan to meet with the MPS Nutrition Department, because the budget that goes to the nutrition department for the lunches, not the school board, if that makes sense.
What are some ways that people that aren't MPS students or MPS parents, what's a way that they can get involved or support?
They can get involved by following our social medias and to share our demands, and they could become a VOSIS member or a YES member. That would really help us a lot.
Great. And I just kind of want to open it up to you. Like, is there anything else that you'd like people to know about YES, the school lunch justice campaign, or just anything, I guess, related to what you're doing?
If you're an MPS high school student and you really like what we're doing, you can come to our Thursday meetings at 5:30 at the VOSIS office on 8th and Mitchell.
Eliza Palacios is a junior at Alexander Hamilton High School and a student organizer for Youth Empowered in the Struggle, also known as YES, the youth arm of Voces de la Frontera. She spoke with Rafa Munoz, WUWM's Community Engagement Coordinator. Did you know you can listen to Lake Effect as a podcast? Well, if you'd like to take us on the go or hear any of the segments on the show, just search for Lake Effect in Apple Podcasts, Google Play, or wherever you get your podcasts to hear us on demand. You can also follow WUWM on Instagram, where you'll find videos and pictures from news stories and Lake Effect interviews. It's no secret that there's a worker shortage in the United States right now. And as we've gone through and are trying to recover from the pandemic, some employees are going back into the office while others are staying at home or perhaps quitting. A lot of factors play into this great resignation. But one thing you may not be considering is the use of automated hiring systems. Think Indeed, ZipRecruiter, or Monster. All of these platforms use algorithms and screening tools to automatically sort and match job seekers with employers. But how truly effective are these platforms? Noelle Chesley is an associate professor of sociology at UW-Milwaukee, and her research looks into the intersection of technology, work, and family. She joins me now and explains how automated hiring systems can be a potential attributor to the worker shortage.
What's happening in the economy is undoubtedly complex. So I do want to emphasize that anything happening with automation via the hiring process is probably just one part of a more complicated picture. But that said, I would say there's two factors actually related to automated hiring systems that could potentially contribute to problems in hiring. And the first is centered around a lack of transparency. So we sometimes describe these automated systems as operating as a black box, where black box is in quotes. And all that really means is that they're able to make connections across applicants or even within a particular job application that are not visible to human observers. So what it means in practice is that neither job applicants or the hiring company may have a full understanding of how applicant information is being used. And that can happen when we're trying to match potential candidates to job ads, whether we're talking about selecting from applicant pools, or even, you know, trying to rank candidates in some kind of way as part of the hiring process. So just as one example, you know, there's matching algorithms on social network sites like Facebook, or, you know, using a search engine such as Google. And those automatically filter who sees job ads in ways that could affect the makeup of an applicant pool. And there's actually some research out there that has found that women are seeing certain types of job ads less than men, for example. And you can imagine that if we're automatically filtering out women from even seeing a job ad, you know, that that's going to impact an organization's access to potentially qualified applicants.
So there's one problem right there in that we're not reaching a full potential applicant pool. But let's fast forward to someone sending in their application via a software, say like LinkedIn, Indeed, Roster, all those kind of applicant pools that people go to, send their resume, see what happens. So how does this software work in general when someone is sending in their application to these job sites?
So, okay, one thing I think that's really important to say is that there isn't just one system or one piece of software. There's all sorts of automation tools that have been developed to attack different parts of the hiring process. And they're offered by different vendors. Companies might be mixing and matching. Some companies might use some pieces, some might use others. So I think that's one really important piece. So just like I was saying with the job ads, you know, a company might post their job ad on LinkedIn, they might post it on Indeed, they might post it on Monster, they might be using an aggregator website, and all of those platforms are using really different algorithms or designs that might work differently. So all of that is to say is that this can be a really complex suite of tools. So it's really hard to say exactly how they're using it. But in general, you know, there's tools that are targeting the job ads to applicants, trying to source candidates, actually get people to apply for jobs. And then once people have done an application, probably through an online platform, which by the way, has been designed with the hiring agent in mind to limit the kind of information that a job applicant can give, they might be using automation tools that are going to filter out some of those applications before a human being ever even looks at them. And they might even provide a scoring system that scores applications on different features depending on what a hiring organization has asked for. There are tools, artificial intelligence tools out there that will ask job applicants to submit an interview, some sort of a video interview, where the questions maybe have already been determined by the hiring organization, or maybe there's an artificial intelligence avatar that's actually conducting the interview, and then there's all sorts of tools that are analyzing the job applicant's performance. There's personality tests and games that are being used to assess job candidates, and all of these things work differently.
So a lot of these automated hiring systems are using algorithms that, let's say, maybe aren't fully vetted or only vetted in certain ways, and there's blind spots. So what are the consequences of using these so widely without really knowing the full scope of what blind spots are missing, whether it's in someone putting out an ad or in the lack of outreach for qualified candidates that may not even see this, or maybe they get sourced out of it before they even get a chance to advance?
Right, right. So important first to acknowledge that just as bias is introduced into hiring through humans, the use of human beings and human decision makers, we also know we can build bias into automated systems. And this is actually a really active area of research right now, really trying to understand all the different ways this can happen. So I'll just say, without getting into the nuts and bolts of the research, that it's a difficult problem to solve. And it's difficult whether we're talking about trying to solve it with humans or solve it with algorithms. But what I think makes the automation part particularly tricky is that transparency issue I talked about earlier. And then the other thing I didn't get a chance to talk about that I'll talk about now is the problem of scale. So the issue with algorithms is that, we use them to try to get more efficiency in a lot of our processes. We're trying to do things more quickly, to process a much larger volume of information, whether it's information about job applicants or anything else. And the scale issue really speaks to the fact that if you automate something that is problematic, say it's introducing a really problematic form of bias, algorithms mean you can do this across millions and millions of cases in an instant. And particularly when we're talking about market-based systems where, organizations are buying maybe just from a handful of vendors who are offering different types of tools, you can imagine how we can scale this across the economy pretty quickly.
So let's kind of walk through a real-time example of that. So how do filters potentially disqualify good potential candidates? Like I've had the experience where I couldn't even check a box online and therefore I didn't get to advance, even though, say, if I was going through actual humans or people, I could explain, like, this is why this box isn't checked and technically I'm still qualified for this, So what kind of other things present itself when filters and automation actually overlook people that would be good potential hires?
Right. So let's talk about how this works. You're a job candidate and you see an ad and it tells you that you have to apply online. So you go online to go ahead and complete this job application. And one of the first potential filtering barriers you could face is on that online application to begin with. So imagine that you are going in to put your birth date in, that's part of the application process. And my birthday, I was born in 1968. I go to the menu and it only goes back to 1990. I can't even put my birthday in there. So maybe my application gets flagged as incomplete, something like that. And it might not ever even make it past that kind of a point. That's a simple example, but all the fields, the way the fields are designed, what they allow people to answer or not answer, right there. There's, unlike a paper form, I could have just written it on there maybe, or maybe if I was speaking to a person, I could tell them. Then say your application does get marked as complete, and it's going to go into this, some sort of a tracking, online tracking system. The next thing that can happen in some cases is the filtering part. So many organizations, especially these larger or mid-sized firms, are automatically filtering out applicants with certain kinds of criteria. So for example, you might be someone who has a gap in your employment of more than 6 months. Something like 48% of employers are automatically filtering out those people from the applicant pool before a human will ever even look at them. You don't get a chance to say why you had that gap. You don't get a chance to say there was a worldwide pandemic and schools closed and someone had to take care of your kids while that was happening. So right away, you might just never even make it to the list of candidates who are actually going to be vetted by a human being. If you even make it into the ranked list, there's been some interesting research that just talks about how very marginal differences between candidates in that list can affect their rank, which again speaks to kind of the complexity and lack of transparency.
Right. We keep touching upon the whole lack of transparency issue, and obviously not everyone is looking into this as thoroughly as you are with your work and job, but I know it's kind of par for the course in the modern working age that we have to use these systems, but are people, specifically those applying for jobs, are we even very trusting of automating hiring systems?
That's a really important question. It's one I'm actually really interested in as a researcher. And I'll just tell you, I mean, I've been doing just a wide range of reading on this topic over the last few months. And I have not been able to locate much in the way of systematic research that tells us how aware job candidates are or job seekers are of the many ways their job hunt is automated. And I think that's a really important question because it speaks to the ability of job seekers to recognize when they're engaged in a problematic or perhaps even illegal hiring process. Now, we do know from public opinion research that the majority of the US population is not enthusiastic about automated hiring. And they find that about 2/3 of Americans believe that automated hiring is not very or not at all fair. About over half, you know, believe that automated hiring is not that effective. And again, another 2/3 find it unacceptable. So that's not job seekers per se, it's just sort of the broader American population. There are studies though that look at this in a more artificial hiring situation. So they might just bring someone into a lab and have them pretend that they're a job seeker. And then, you know, people get different conditions in the lab about how they would make certain types of decisions if they were actually looking for a job. And that research is actually kind of mixed. So there's some studies that suggest kind of generally that people find this idea of being evaluated by algorithm or by some kind of automated system as pretty unfair. They don't like it. But there's some other studies that suggest that it could be considered more favorable in some circumstances. So if a job seeker has had an experience with discrimination in the past, maybe with a human agent, some of those job seekers appear to want automation in that kind of a situation. There's also been some interesting research that's looked at if job seekers actually think one system over another will be more favorable for them, they'll prefer that system. So if they think they're going to get a better outcome with a human, they want a human. If they think they're going to get a better outcome with automation, they want automation. So I don't think we really know the answer to this. I think this is an area that really needs more research, and I think it's a really important question.
Noelle Chesley is an associate professor of sociology at UW-Milwaukee. We'll take one more break and then learn about the astronomy and mythology behind the zodiac Leo with contributor Gene Creighton. Keep listening to Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.
This is Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Do you know your zodiac sign? Would you know how to find it in the night sky? Well, to help us learn about the astronomy and mythology behind the zodiac, I'm joined by Lake Effect astronomy contributor Jean Creighton. She's the director of the UW-Milwaukee Manfred Olson Planetarium. The planetarium's been hosting a new series of events based on the zodiac, and this month they're highlighting Leo. Jean, welcome back to Lake Effect.
It is lovely to be with you, Audrey.
So we have been talking about the constellations along with the Manfred Olson Planetarium's programming that dives into each one, and this month is Leo. So where is Leo in the night sky, and what does it look like to our eyes?
Leo looks like a backward question mark. And a great way of finding it is if you imagine the Big Dipper, which I often describe as a shopping cart with a long, curvy handle, imagine that the shopping cart has a leak and it's dripping. The water hits the head of Leo and that irritates him, which is a great way of remembering where Leo is.
And with Leo being so close to some of these other noticeable constellations in the night sky, I'm also wondering about any of the deep sky objects housed within Leo.
Leo does have many galaxies in it. And what's neat about them is sometimes people imagine that galaxies are all spirals. And in fact, there are three different kinds of galaxies, and they're all of these types within Leo. So yes, of course, there are spirals, but spirals come in two flavors. There are the classic spirals and there are the barred spirals. So barred spirals means that in addition to the cool arms that you see, there is something that looks almost like a bar magnet in the center. And we think our own galaxy is one of these barred galaxies. So in addition to spiral galaxies, there are also elliptical galaxies, which are much more, how to put it gently, plain, because they basically look like balls, and it can be a nice round ball, but it can also be more the shape of a hot dog, if you will. So those are ellipticals. And then everything else is under the irregular label. And that's usually because a galaxy or two are interacting and they don't have yet some, you know, beautifully formed final shape, but they're still kind of messy. And those are irregular galaxies.
Part of looking at the galaxies and kind of the differences, I feel like we're getting a much better picture, I guess pun intended, of these because of the recent work from the James Webb Space Telescope, right?
Mm-hmm. Yes. So the very first image actually that was released was showing multiple galaxies in one picture. If you think about it, your mind explodes, right? You're looking at a teeny little piece of sky that has thousands of galaxies in that one image. And what's neat about it is you can estimate the distance to each of those galaxies and you realize, oh, I'm seeing multiple layers of time. It's almost like you're doing an archaeological dig and you're seeing the ones that are they're closer to you are more recent. And the ones that you see further back in space are also, you're seeing them as they were younger in time. And that really gives us a sense of how galaxies change. And for the particular, that first image that we saw, there was a gravitational, what we call a gravitational lens. So you're looking at a distant galaxy through what we call a cluster of galaxies. And the cluster of galaxies literally bends light of the distant galaxy in the background. And you see multiple images of the same faraway galaxy. And because it operates that intermediate cluster of galaxies is kind of like a lens, it also makes the very distant galaxy bigger so you can notice it. And if you think I'm geeking out here, I am completely geeking out that we are able to see some of the oldest. Now we have seen the farthest galaxies we can in a few hours of time something. We smashed the record that the Hubble Space Telescope had after observing a particular point in sky for many weeks. So this is a much more powerful telescope, and I'm hoping, as I'm sure the team is hoping, that they'll be able to see the very, very first stars ever formed.
Kind of blows your mind, but I think all of our minds were collectively shattered when that first image came out.
Right.
It's hard to comprehend. And bringing it back to Leo, I know Leo has 13 stars with planets in it as well.
Yeah, and that beautifully ties in with the James Webb Space Telescope as well, because one of the scientific goals that the James Webb has is to find planets around other stars that are suitable for life in our kind of viewpoint of what life wants. And that means that we want it to have an atmosphere that has nice gases, like stuff that life makes on Earth, like oxygen and methane. And people often ask me, well, how do we know that some other life is like ours, is chemistry based on carbon? Which is a very fair question. We don't know that. But it's hard enough to find life that's like ours. Forget about, at this point, finding life that we wouldn't even know it's life. So for now, we're limiting ourselves to the kinds of sort of pillars of life as we understand them on Earth.
And to quote Contact, it would be an awful waste of space.
Yes, yes. So it's a very, you know, it's a fundamentally interesting question to ask whether there's life outside the Earth.
So we've been talking about all the stars and galaxies hidden within the sky and within Leo, but let's talk about the mythology behind the lion itself.
Sure. I am happy to tell you the myth around Leo, which is connected to Hercules' story, which is often the case, actually, for the zodiacs. So this was the very first labor of Hercules. And I'll remind you that Hercules is the son of Zeus, but not the son of Zeus's wife, Ida, which means, sadly, that Ida basically had it in for Hercules ever since he was born. So she made it so that Hercules had to work with a particular cowardly king and do the bidding of the king. So the king asked him, Evristheus, asked him to kill the lion of Nemea. Nemea is a beautiful wine country in the Peloponnese in Greece. And the thing about this lion was it came from a line of monsters all the way up to Medusa. This was a nasty creature that you couldn't kill with anything sharp. And Hercules fought the lion for 40 days and 40 nights with his bare hands, the story goes, until eventually he strangled the lion. Now he thought probably he wanted the pelt of the lion because then he could show off to the world and say, I killed the lion of Nemea, but how are you going to do that? He took one of the claws of the lion to cut the skin and prepare. Often Hercules is shown with a lion skin over himself. So not only did that help him brag, but it also protected his back. It meant that if somebody were to try and shoot him from behind, it would not have been a successful venture. Now, Zeus wanted to honor the wonderful, beautiful lion, and that's why Leo got to be in the sky as well. And in fact, one of the brightest stars in the sky, the 21st brightest star, is called Regulus. After all, that is a kingly name for the kingly lion. And that is a star that we can see in the city.
Jean, thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank you so much.
Jean Creighton is our regular astronomy contributor and the director of the Manfred Olson Planetarium at UW-Milwaukee. Their live interactive show, Constellations of the Zodiac Leo, takes place tomorrow evening. You can explore our past astronomy conversations at wuwm.com. And that's Lake Effect for today. I'm Audrey Nowakowski.
Joy Powers and Mallory Chang join me in producing Lake Effect each week with help from Kate Flynn and Chase Browning. Becky Mortensen is our executive producer. We also heard from Emily Files, Taryn Powell, and Eddie Morales from the WUWM News team this week. We also heard from Rafa Munoz, WUWM's Community Engagement Coordinator. Jason Reavy is our studio engineer. Michelle Maternowski is our digital manager. Valerio Navarra-Viegas is our digital editor. Trapper Shep wrote our theme music. Join us again Monday at noon for the latest Capitol Notes, where we'll fill you in on the latest developments in key primary races. Plus, Bubbler Talk looks into the more than century-old road that links Lake Park to the lakefront. If you've missed any of Lake Effect this week, you can find all of our conversations at WUWM.com. If you'd like to take the show on the go, you can download the Lake Effect podcast from Apple Podcasts, Google Play, or wherever you listen to your podcasts. Thanks so much for joining us today, right here on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.